Why are you whistling Thunderbirds?
Because you said, is this now in the thing? Are we now doing thing? But it's because...
This is take two, by the way.
This is take two. Yeah. Take two. It's because you had gestured that something, that you were in some pain.
Yes.
And I said, because I care, are you all right? And you said, I don't know, but I'll keep going because it's what we do.
Yes.
And I said, I can't hear anyone say that without hearing the Thunderbirds movie when after he saves Mr. The Hood by Sir Ben Kingsley, yeah. He says, why do you do that? Because I'm a Tracy and it's what we do.
Oh, right. That's true. I haven't really remembered very much about that film.
No, nobody does. Everybody other than me thinks it's pants, but I've seen it many times and I like it very much.
Anyway, Dr. Footlights will attend to all our discomforts.
Sorry, Dr. Footlights is that just like when you turn the microphone on?
I imagine it's a kind of a theatre thing. You know, I'm not feeling very good, but Dr. Footlights
will attend.
Yeah, as soon as you step on stage, everything is fine.
My favourite is the Morecambe and Wise sketch, which is the doing of that joke when they're stumbling around in the kitchen and they're like blah 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 blah, and then they open the fridge and the light goes on and ba da 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 da.
That's very good. I need to watch that again. An email from the splendidly named Marnie Tenterhook.
Wow. Tenterhook is a genuine surname.
As a genuine surname. I mean, it might be an alias or a stage name or whatever.
Well, keep it.
Firstly, thank you for the... here we go. Thank you to the top... This is how it got...
Hang on, you haven't done the... who's it addressed to?
Dear Dewey and Huey.
Thank you very much.
Thank you to the top production team for all the work. As a fellow techie who works behind the curtain, I know how important you are in making the magic happen. Mark and Simon, you're great too. Yeah, you see, Marnie, that's the wrong way round. Mm-hmm. I discovered you both as a teenager and have been listening to the show for some time now. In that time, you have steered my viewing choices. Da, 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 da. I have just...
What do you mean, da, 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 da?
Well, you know, just general kind of puff pastry. I've just seen Silent Running. What a week to watch it. Oh. I am already playing it again as I write to you. I imagine Mark will once again say what a brilliant film it is and encourage anyone who hasn't seen it yet to do so with
urgency. Anyone who hasn't seen it yet should fix that immediately.
If you were to write a list of films to be made compulsory viewing, mm-hmm. like a curriculum for moral improvement,
yes.
what would you include?
Films
with a message of kindness, empathy and humanity. Films that make us question anything that is wrong with the world and how we can make it better. Hello to Jason, down with soaring temperatures and up with people caring enough to have a dream. The thing is, this is quite a good list, but the idea of...
That's a solid running, quite well done.
Films for moral improvement.
Yeah.
Makes me feel very kind of, well...
Okay, so can I...
Slightly suspicious of someone who wants to improve my morals, but anyway.
No, they don't want to improve your morals. They work. Okay, so here, so two things I say. Firstly, we were just speaking on take one about Kurt Vonnegut, Unstuck in Time. And Vonnegut's recurrent phrases were, one of them is, so it goes. So he'd describe almost, so it goes. No matter what happens, so it goes, which is a kind of a sort of Tom Hanks-y, you know, it is what it is, all this will pass. But having discussed religion and philosophy and all the rest, his conclusion is, damn it, you've got to be kind. And that was his philosophy. Do what you want, but you've got to be kind. And actually, I think in terms of moral improvement, just damn it, you've got to be kind is great. So I would cite the Vonnegut documentary. I would say Mary Poppins because I think it, and I'm not joking about this, I think it is genuinely a film with a deeply sort of moral core. I think Silent Running is almost terrifying now because it seems so horrifically prescient, but I still think it's an absolute heartbreaker and wonderful. And if you've enjoyed Brian and Charles, then do see Silent Running because it's, you know, films about robots and AI are often cut right to the heart of the human condition. And what do you think? A film for moral improvement?
I mean, I'll go along with... I just don't like the idea of a film for, you know, someone thinks it's a worthy film, so therefore that you need to...
But the thing that's interesting is I think all those films that I cited, I don't think any of them set out to be films about moral improvement. They just happen to be that. Films that set out to be about moral improvement. I mean, I remember once somebody this was back in the days when I was at university and we were doing, you know, criticism, critical theory, which I think we did in 6 months because it was always considered to be like wiffle and flim flam. They said that there was a time when all approved Russian literature was basically a version of Boy Meets Tractor, which I thought was very funny. And then it was, you know, but that the whole thing about something which is designed with, and that's why faith movies with a capital F are always, as Father Peter Malone, you know, the World Catholic Media Organization said so pointedly, it was, if you have a faith movie, when you know that the moral of this story is believe in God, you tend not to.
Yes.
The stories that work are the stories in which the drama is what engages you. And then that's why I think The Exorcist is actually, because a bunch of people went to see The Exorcist who went because they wanted to see a shocking, terrifying movie. And they ran out and ran into a church. If you want to make an argument for church recruitment, The Exorcist is the godfather. It's the big daddy, you know. I mean, that famous interview with that minister who says, we were turning them away after The Exorcist opened. You know, they had like years and years of, anyone out there? You know, we shall now sing hymn 257. Jeffrey, if you'd like to join in. And then the next week, they were literally turning them away.
Blimey. Megan in Edinburgh. Dear North London and North by Northwest, medium-term listener, first-time correspondent. Last weekend, I turned 30, and my partner of 7 years threw me a surprise birthday party. I knew something was happening, but none of the details, only that she had disappeared on a few occasions to make mysterious phone calls. She also kept saying,
she's having an affair. That's not a birthday party. That's the Pina Colada song.
Take one. She also kept saying, I hope you enjoy it, in a slightly nervous way, which raised the concern that it might be something requiring a certain degree of forbearance.
Okay.
You know, like bowling or stand-up comedy. Or else unpleasantly adrenaline-fueled like bungee jumping, which I would not have enjoyed. Of course, I needn't have worried. On the day itself, she had organised a celebration with my family and friends at a local pub on Scotland's first and possibly last day of summer sunshine, followed by a special screening at the Dominion, an independent cinema that has operated since 1938 out of a listed Art Deco building in Edinburgh's Morningside area. I grew up in Edinburgh and had my 9th birthday party there, when friends and I dressed up as witches to see the first Harry Potter film.
Oh, wow.
This weekend, we sat down in one of the Dominion's plush small screens to watch Sally Potter's Orlando, now 30 years old like me. It was a brilliant choice.
Blimey.
With its stunning costumes, playful cinematography, remarkable central performance by Tilda Swinton, who appears not to have aged at all.
No.
It's a film, above all, that celebrates queer joy, wearing its politics lightly but seriously, in capturing the beauty of gender and desire in all their forms. Like the novel by Virginia Woolf, it is a film of its time and for our times, reminding us that everything we think of as new or modern really has a very long history. It just wore different clothes. Everyone loved it, and the staff at the Dominion were charming hosts. So I'd like to thank them and thank Fiona, my partner, for such a perfect surprise. Hello to Jason, with Bluehead Feminists and all the Orlandos out there.
And which friend of the show features in a person standing in a lineup of four people but out-acting all of them without saying a single word in
Jason?
Orlando? No.
David?
The other one.
Sanjeev?
Keep going. I'll do an impression.
Fairport Convention?
No, I'll do an impression, okay? This is what he looks like in the lineup.
You just look prissy and...
No, well, it's...
Captain Mannering?
No, Toby Jones, heaven's
Toby
sake.
Jones. I don't know, I haven't seen...
That was my impression of Toby Jones. Didn't look like Toby Jones?
No, it did not look like Toby Jones.
Toby, just... Simon thinks you look prissy.
But, interestingly,
yes.
I said Captain Mannering.
Yes.
And who played Captain Mannering?
Toby Jones.
So, in a way, that was you led me in a particular path and I got there, but...
Do you know what the name of Toby Jones's character is in Orlando?
No.
Second Valet. No. That's how he's listed on the IMDb. Toby Jones as second, not even first valet, second valet, and yet still upstaging everybody.
Tim Clayton, Mark and Simon, wanted to tell you about my favourite place in the world.
Okay.
It's a small single screen cinema called Kino Astra,
okay,
in the tiny town of Oborniki Slaski in Poland. It opened up in August 2020 with a screening of Tenet after years of work renovating a disused old theatre.
Hang on, in 2020?
Yes.
Oh, that's nicely palindromic. Although, no, it isn't, isn't it? That'd be 202. Never mind, moving on. I just thought it was...
Thanks. Yeah. Of course, after all the hard work, the first months were a struggle with social distancing, only a quarter of the seats on sale and no food and drink allowed. But the ladies who manage and run the cinema and the lovely little cafe battled through and have managed to show films four nights a week almost without interruption. When it did have to close down for just a few weeks in early 21, they still showed the films that they had planned by staying open until 5 minutes to midnight before lockdown, with a double bill of Nomadland and Sound of Metal.
Wow.
Sometimes it was almost empty, but over time the cinema has become something more than just a place to see films. It's now a cultural hub for a small town, with more and more people turning up to see movies each week as they discover its magic. The ladies who run the place have stuck to their vision of what cinema should be. Instead of only showing blockbusters and getting people through the door, they mix Top Gun and Thor with independent films from Iceland, Spain, Poland, France, Titan, Sex with a Car, Korea,
You're
Japan.
You're never going to get over that, are you?
All over the world. They also run a seniors film club, a women's film club. They show LGBTQ plus films in a country where such things are often dangerously marginalised. Oh. They even showed free cartoons in Ukrainian for the many refugee children who arrived in our town.
Wow, this sounds
this
brilliant.
Year.
What's this cinema called again?
It is called Kino Astra in Oborniki Slaski.
That sounds wonderful.
I've made a point of going every single week it's been open to see whatever is on. Sometimes I go alone, sometimes with my wife, sometimes with my teenagers, sometimes with my four-year-old. For me, it's been an incredibly healing place in these last 2 years of mental stress. It's been the destination where I could go every weekend to just relax and be told someone else's story instead of living in my own head. My own dream is to one day sit in the cinema and watch a film that I contributed to in some way as a scriptwriter, producer, translator, making the tea, whatever. There is a website where you can look at the place, which I'm going to mention here, which is Kino Astra, KINOASTRA.PL/, oh my goodness me, /O-NAS/.
Okay. Excellent.
Okay. Maybe we can put this in our show notes if
yes.
those things
put it,
are there.
We can put it on, can we tweet it? We can tweet it on the Kermode and Mayo's Take. Follow us on Twitter.
KinoAstra.PL/O-NAS/. Anyway, it may be small and humble, but it really is proof that provincial cinema is not dead. In fact, it breathes life into our small town.
That's brilliant.
And Tim talks about that cinema in the way people talk about the pub or the post office
yeah.
or the church or whatever. It's like,
yeah.
this is who we are and we go all the time.
Yeah, it's lovely. And how great as well that he's going every week to support it. That's the thing. You know, it's if you have a cinema that you love, patronise it. And I don't mean patronise it by going, well done.
You've done so well. Thank you.
It's funny, isn't it, that that word means two things that are completely different.
I know, depending on the tone. One Frame Back, Deep South Films. So One Frame Back, exploring films sort of connected in some way.
Adjacent
to one of the week's releases. Deep South movies came about because of Where the Crawdads Sing. Quite a lot to look at, I would
think.
Go
ahead.
Morven in Edinburgh. I really loved, and for obvious reasons, despaired, the film Loving, about a mixed-race couple yeah. in the South battling to be legally allowed to marry.
Yes.
I seem to remember a weekend of watching this, Fences and Hidden Figures at the cinema and feeling... I seem to remember a weekend of watching this, Fences...
And Hidden Figures
at the cinema. And
that's quite the weekend.
Very down about the state of race relations in the not-so-distant past. Loving was a beautiful film, and all I kept saying to myself was, just let them marry and be happy. Thankfully, I didn't scream this out loud in the somewhat full cinema, as tempting as it was. Keep up all the excellent takes, says Morven.
Very good.
Greetings from the United States, says Grant. My choice for One Frame Back for film set in the Deep South is Jeff Nichols' Mud, a super underrated coming-of-age film. The
yeah,
performances
great.
By Matthew McConaughey and Ty Sheridan are phenomenal. And Nichols crafts a movie... This is complicated because every single word in this sentence has a capital letter.
Okay.
Ty Sheridan are phenomenal. And Nicholas crafts a moving Twain-esque folktale about childhood and love.
Very good.
PB says, Walter Hill's Southern Comfort. Couldn't tell you how many times I rented that from Tavistock Video Shop in Bedford back in the 80s.
Honestly, I know being nostalgic for old video stores is so 90s, but it's just, yeah.
Catherine Morell, 2012's Magical Beasts of the Southern Wild.
Which, of course, is, as we said, shares a writing connection with where the Crawdads sing in terms of the screenplay.
Dear Boss Hogg and Sheriff Roscoe P. Coltrane, says Michael from Belfast, I was excited to hear you were searching for film recommendations related to the American Deep South, as this was the very topic I studied for my MA film dissertation.
Oh, wow. Okay.
More specifically, how films set in the Deep South examined religion and its relationship with violence, race and sex. Although the Deep South as an area can often defy definition, please allow me to offer up a quick list of some of my favourite films set in traditionally southern states. Bill Paxton's Frailty.
Yeah, very good.
Cassie Lemons' Eve's Bayou.
Which is a terrific movie.
Charles Laughton's Night of the Hunter.
Which is one of the creepiest films ever made.
And Robert Duvall's The Apostle are possibly underseen and well worth seeking out. However, I want to draw attention to two of my favourites from this niche genre. John Huston's Wise Blood from the Flannery O'Connor novel and Alan Parker's Angel Heart. Both of which show how the Deep South religiosity can be alluring, vicious, and complex.
Okay. Well, you remember when I said to you, I bet you nobody's going to choose my Deep South choice.
Michael from Belfast has done just
that. You went
that.
Through all of that, and then just when I thought I was going to go, well, it's interesting that nobody has mentioned...
The one. Anyway, well, just one more.
There's email. More,
okay. Lee says, This is great timing. I write this keeping a sensibly low profile indoors under the UK's record-breaking temperatures.
Yeah, well done. Do you want to put that in context, incidentally, of what you saw in Golden Square on the day of the record-breaking...
Oh, in central London, at midday on the officially
on the
hottest
day, the earth
day
caught
of
fire.
Britain, people sunbathing. And...
In the middle of the day?
I did feel like going up to people and saying... Have you not been listening to anything or read anything? Do you not know what is happening? You know? And I speak as someone with sun-damaged skin, you know, and just thinking, but really?
Really?
You have no excuse.
Really?
Anyway, Lee says, quite a list of potential films. Loads I love and respect. Down by Law. In the Heat of Night, To Kill a Mockingbird, but these ones I never tire of rewatching. Even if they weren't shot there, they seem to embody my idea of the Deep South.
Yeah.
Deliverance, Southern Comfort, The Long Hot Summer, Cool Hand Luke, Bernie, Shotgun Stories, No Country for Old Men, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Love and Lower Temperatures from Lee. So
that's very good.
Where are
can
we
I just,
go?
Okay, firstly, can I just, on the subject of Down by Law, Zach, Bob, hey, if you throw a ball at me, I throw a ball at you.
Is Jared,
my mother, she's a very funny woman. She's very, say, hey, come, I say, Hoo! Very funny woman. Anyway,
I didn't get any of that, but here we go.
Well, in this case, Bob, I think you'd have to say I look at the window. So the choice that I was going for, which I was feeling so smug and pleased with myself about until it was spoiled by whom?
Michael in Belfast.
Angel Heart. And the reason Angel Heart was the top of the list for me is this. So half of Angel Heart takes place in New York and half of Angel Heart takes place in the Deep South, down in New Orleans. And the reason that that is really important is that the novel doesn't. The novel all takes place in New York. And what happens in the transition from the novel to the film is the move that when Harry Angel is investigating the whole Evangeline Bradford story, he goes to the Deep South, and that's where the majority of the action plays out. And it is one of the brilliant examples of a film understanding that a film and a novel are not the same thing. And therefore, that whole immersion in the religion and music and culture of that area. I mean, there are things about Angel Heart that one could, you know, claim was, I think, quite legitimately sort of problematic and sometimes exoticized. But it is a really brilliant cinematic device. This isn't going to work if we stay here. We have to go where the story is going. Where do we go? That's where we go. And I think I was having a discussion with somebody the other day about what a brilliant performance Mickey Rourke gives in that film. And I mean, I think Mickey Rourke is an idiot now, but I think his performance in that film is just astonishing. And I mean, you think about the early Mickey Rourke, you know, Pub Greenwich Village and... Diner and things like that. He's so good in Angel Heart. It's like absolutely peak Mickey Rourke. And Alan Parker, God bless Alan Parker. When Alan Parker was on his game, when he was at his most cinematic, I don't care what anyone says about, your Stanley Kubricks and your... Alan Parker was a visual stylist like no other, and he knew how to tell stories. And Angel Heart is a genius film, and the location is absolutely the story.
Okay, so the one frame back is Angel Heart, which I imagine is widely available.
Widely available. That's, it's available on widely available.
The widely available channel, $9.99 monthly subscription. Next week, Mark is reviewing DC League of Super Pets.
Yes, I'm really looking forward to that. This press show is on Monday morning.
Your picks for animated animal movies. Why don't we just say animal movies? Do they have to
animated.
Be animated? I know. Does it have to be animated?
Well, I don't mind. I didn't write it. It needs to be animated. Yeah.
Why?
Hang on, I'm going to put Hannah on the. I'm going to put my headphones around the microphone. Hang on.
Yeah, we need to do animated animal movies because otherwise we'll run out of one frame backs.
Okay, everyone, did you all get that?
Next week, Mark is going to be reviewing DC League of Super Pets.
And seeing it on Monday morning.
I can't wait. I wish it could be with you.
Apparently, the cinema's top air conditioned.
We'd like to know your picks for animated animal movies.
AAM.
Lion King.
Oh, and there we go. So, okay.
so that's it.
It's a short feature,
so,
wasn't it?
Anyway, so that and others can be referenced. Correspondence at CurbanAmeo.com. Now, take it or leave it, you decide our word of mouth thing.
Yes.
Elena in Birmingham had suggested that we talk about Midnight Mass.
Yeah.
And last week you were talking about watching episodes 1 to 3.
Yes, which I did do.
So before you crack on,
yeah.
Matthew Steele says... long time, heritage, first time, all that. I was pleased to hear you enjoyed Midnight Mass. It scratched a particular melancholic existential itch for me. That being said, I laughed when I saw it described online as, quotes, midnight monologue. Really? Characters drift into wonderfully acted and poetically written monologues, even mid-dramatic explosive grand guignol revelation. Just explain what a mid-dramatic explosive grand guignol revelation would be.
Grand guignol is sort of theatre of sadism and cruelty and horror, comes from apparently the théâtre de grand guignol, but now generally means...
Big puppets.
Yes, literally big puppets, but now Grand Guignol means gore and, you know, horror, visceral horror on screen.
So a mid-dramatic explosive, yeah. One of those. These speeches often reach many minutes in length. Actually, I agree with this. And it did test my patience, particularly when the climactic pieces were falling into place only to be interrupted. That being said, it was all worth it for the callback to one monologue in particular. And I loved the series and its gothic imagery, especially the moment in the cave. Nathaniel, dear Dr. Sarah and Father Paul, first time emailer. Physics student at Leiden, the Netherlands, which is definitely not in Scandinavia. So that proves Nathaniel.
As we now know.
Well, as we all knew all the time.
Well, I think...
You thought it was in Scandinavia.
Yeah. Agree to disagree.
Well, you did think it was in Scandinavia.
Yeah. You know, potato, potato.
But no, it's just potato. It was wonderful to hear Simon talk last week about how much he'd enjoyed Mike Flanagan's Midnight Mass while usually not being a horror fan. A few years ago, I would have thought it impossible that I would have ever loved horror, but this has now changed. Midnight Mass affected me in the same way as Guillermo del Toro's The Devil's Backbone. Wow. It is a series which really understands the way in which supernatural horror can show human realities like no other kind of story can. The series shows faith with nuance, especially emphasizing how often we see the same thing but use different words. An angel or a vampire, mm-hmm. God or the cosmos, a miracle or an infection. It is a beautiful piece of work, and if Mark and Simon have not seen Flanagan's adaptation of The Haunting of Hill House yet, what do you think? I have no doubt that they will love it. Up with horror, down with elevated, says Nathaniel.
Yeah. So I do agree with that, you know.
Yeah. So the thing about Midnight Mass, we mentioned this at the beginning, I think, of take one.
Yeah.
That, so we're now talking about the last three episodes of Midnight Mass, which is on Netflix, which is therefore going to involve a degree of spoilering, because you can't really talk about the end of something without talking about the end of something. So if you haven't seen it and you want to come back to this bit, then that's fine. But this is just flagging up that these are thoughts about how it finished.
So when I talked about this last week, I had started watching it and I had been, I liked the world, I liked the island, I liked the sort of the theology of it. I liked the fact that you knew there was something going on, but you weren't quite sure what. It has a very striking opening with a drunk driver causing a death that he is then imprisoned for, and he then returns to the island full of guilt. The island has all these kind of internecine secrets. There is a thing very, very early on, because he starts praying as soon as he commits, as soon as he does the terrible thing, he starts praying, and the guy says, "While you're about it, why don't you ask God why he always takes the children but leaves the, you know, the drunken wretches like you?" And then you arrive at Crockett Island, which is kind of like a twisted, you know, gothic version of Amity. And there is a new minister in the church who then appears to encourage a miracle. There is a young woman in a wheelchair who has been put in the wheelchair by the local drunk firing off firearms. Said it was a hunting accident. So it is not a hunting accident. He was just drunk and he was just shooting. And then he's offering the sacrament during communion, and he holds the sacrament out to her just too far away for her to reach. And then as she reaches forward for it, he backs off and she follows a bit more and he backs off, and then he walks up the steps and everyone's going, "What are you doing? This is really cruel. Why?" And he says, "You know, come on, you know you can do it." And there is this miracle, what appears to be a miracle, that she gets up, albeit uncertainly, from the chair. And then the word goes round the community, a miracle has happened. And the next thing, the church is like the day after the, you know, the exorcist ceremony, the church is turning people away because everyone is coming seeking the miracle. Now, at that point, I didn't know where the story was going. I did not know, because I hadn't read anything about it. I just knew that you and I discussed, and you said, "Oh, you saw the whole thing and you really enjoyed it." And then you made a joke about being bitten by an insect.
I had two mosquito bites on my neck. Yeah. This is last week.
Okay, and which was more information than I knew, because I didn't know anything about it at all. Having watched the rest of it now, I was really impressed. I was really impressed because although it is working within the area of, and if you haven't watched it yet, stop now, watch it, and then come back to this. Although it's working in the area of vampire mythology, it is primarily about exactly the thing that previous emailer said, the way that people can interpret and see the same thing and interpret it different ways. I've always been fascinated by this idea of, you know, Lucifer as the fallen angel, okay? I do think the fiery angel story is for me, a kind of creation myth. And if you're a fan of the writings of William Peter Blatty, you'll know that his novel Legion is inspired by Jack Vizard's theory of the angel. And he talks at great length about what the fiery angel is, what Lucifer, the light bearer, is. And that thing about angel and devil being two parts of the same thing is always something which has fascinated me. So what this is doing is playing into that. This is a religious establishment that has seen an angel that has been given the blood of the new covenant. Now, I know that these are not entirely original ideas, because obviously they're so sort of central to the genre that they've been worked at before. But I thought what was great about this was you actually believed in him as a preacher.
Definitely.
You actually believed in her, the kind of the very zealous woman who becomes even more zealous.
She's a nightmare.
She is a nightmare. And there is that brilliant thing, this is in the final episode, when she says, we're going to get on the boats. And he says, "They've burnt the boats." And she says, never mind, we'll get the ferry. Who they? And it's really threatening, the kind of, just the use of the word that, who are they? I thought I believed in the individual.
Why didn't I remember in the early episodes particularly thinking, why isn't anyone standing up to her? Because she seems to be getting away with this kind of church elder figure who becomes very important into the story. She seems to be getting away with an awful lot. And I just wanted,
including poisoning the dog.
Yeah, all that. And I thought someone should have stood up to her a bit. Anyway, so I was a bit frustrated about that. But it's a small kind of footnote.
Well, can I just say, we are all aware of people in societies, particularly sort of closeted, closed societies, who everyone's going, why do we let them get away with it? But we do. I mean, I probably will grow up to be one of those people who, I mean, maybe already now, people, why do we let him get away with it? Because we do. Actually, that didn't bother me, because I thought that smacked of truth. There is so many, why do we let them behave like that? And every time she's confronted, she has a fantastically snake-tongued answer that does that thing about quoting. Remember you talked about an episode of The West Wing in which Martin Sheen's president responds to, there's an evangelical Christian in the, tell me what the quote was.
Okay. Yes. So there's an evangelical talk show host who has been giving President Bartlet a hard time. And then he, it's very, very early on, I think it might be episode one or episode two. And it's a classic Aaron Sorkin script, which I'm not going to do justice to. But basically, he walks into the room and out quotes the Bible to her.
Yep.
And, you know, points out all the kind of overtly horrible things that you're requested to do by various books, in the particularly in the Old Testament. And should I do this? And should I tell Leo McGarry to, that he needs to execute his daughter? Or I can't remember all the things. But anyway, basically outquotes the Bible to this Bible-believing even. Sorry. That's the devil.
It's a visual gag. Yeah, that's the devil. The devil made you do that.
Just knocked my microphone. And then he, and then at the end he says, oh, and by the way, in my White House, when the president walks in, everybody stands. And she realized she's the only one sitting down. And it's just an incredible takedown. And I remember seeing that thinking, I've never seen that in a British drama. That's incredible.
Yeah.
And obviously it's more of an issue in America. It really hurt my hand, by the way.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. I shall bleed silently.
Because it's what we do.
It is what we do. I should carry on. But now I want to go and watch that scene again.
But I see, I think that what Midnight Mass does is the reason it works is because the religious stuff, the churchy stuff, rings true. You actually do believe in that. You do believe in him as a preacher. I mean, obviously, later on we discover that he's not just who he appears to be. He's actually, you know, a kind of a rejuvenated character. So I'm trying not to spoil something. We never talked about the ending.
But
anyway,
we have said, you know, if you don't want to know what happened.
No, exactly. But I absolutely bought into him, and he has a brilliant way of delivering this. I mean, you raised this question about the monologues, the midnight monologue thing. I didn't mind. The only time that the monologuing struck me as slightly over-egged is at the very, very end, when she does that whole thing about what does dying feel like? You remember this? Mm-hmm. And then there is a 5-minute thing about, well, you become, you know, one with everything and I see everything. So, but I didn't mind because I figured I've spent 7 hours of my life watching this. You go for it.
It just struck me as one of those things that if this had been on a conventional channel and you literally had to have episodes at 30 minutes, as opposed to in the stream where it could be 42 or it could be 39, whatever, that some of them would have been, well, we're nitpicking here.
Okay. Talking about being able to trim something down I can live with it because 3 episodes in, I was, okay, I am completely gripped by the characters. And the fact that it takes its time before it plays its hand is really good. But I also like the fact that even when the monstrousy stuff starts happening, it's still absolutely rooted in the idea of a small, isolated island with a church, which is the center of the island, and this kind of God-fearing, in inverted commas, community are basically coming to worship a vampire.
Yes. Also, the effects, when they need the effects, are brilliantly done. Never, you don't at any stage go, that's a bit shonky. I thought they were all, it was all very, very good. And as we mentioned last week, it's a limited series, which is a magical word because there should be more. We're going to tell the story. We're going to stop. We're not going to go into season 2 because it doesn't need a season 2. That's the end.
Yeah. And also the communal singing of songs.
Yes.
Will never quite be the same. I mean, I think the scene when they go through the village with the candles is really something. I think the final scene of the scene of the sun coming up is really well done. And no, I thought it was great. I think it was really terrific. And congratulations to everyone involved. I'm sure they've been waiting for that. Well done.
So that is Midnight Mass. You can find it on Netflix. Once you've seen it, let us know what you think. We can keep this conversation going. correspondence@kermanandmayer.com. That's it for Take 2. Thank you very much indeed for being part of the heart of this show.
Part of the heart.
Part of the heart. The ventricle. Is that a part of the heart? I think it probably is. Thanks for being a Vanguardista. There'll be more soon.